And praise you for the answer to that, Father, because I know you're going to do it in Yeshua's name. Amen. Okay. We're going to go ahead and get started. I'm going to read to you from verse 24 through the end of the chapter in chapter 43 of Genesis. And here it goes. And the man, that is the steward of Joseph's house, brought the men, that is Joseph's brothers, to Joseph's house and gave them water. And they washed their feet and he gave their... asses provender. And they made ready the present against Joseph's servant. Our father is in good health. He is yet alive. And they bowed down their heads and made obeisance, or however you say that word. And he lifted up his eyes and saw his brother Benjamin, his mother's son, and said, "Is this your younger brother, of whom you spake unto me?" And he said, "God be gracious unto thee, my son." And Joseph made haste, for his bowels did yearn upon his brother, and he sought where to weep. And he entered into his chamber and wept there. And he washed his face, and went out, and refrained himself, and said, "Set on bread." And they set on for him by himself, and for them by themselves, and for the Egyptians which did eat with them by themselves, because the Egyptians might not eat bread with the Hebrews, for that is an abomination unto the Egyptians. And they sat before him, and the firstborn according to his birthright, and the youngest according to his youth. And the men marveled one at another. And he took and sent messes unto them from before him. But Benjamin's mess was five times as much as any of the others. And they drank and were merry with him. Okay. Joseph's steward brought water for their feet, and while they were washing them, gave provender to their animals. 22 years before, Joseph was steward of Potiphar's house, and is now steward of Pharaoh's kingdom. While this steward had no real power, I think he was probably the most trusted man in the house and Joseph's confidant, and that he knew who these guys were and what was going to transpire that day. If anyone in Egypt besides Potipharah and Asenath knew Joseph's heart, it was this steward. I would not be surprised if there was a David and Jonathan relationship between them. And he gave Joseph's brothers serious and close attention and deference. While they were waiting for Joseph to come with lunch, they got together the present sent from Yaakov. And here's what Yaakov said in 43:11. "Take the best fruits of the land in your vessels and carry down the man a present, a little balm and a little honey, spices and myrrh and nuts and almonds." Now the balm is a healing ointment. When Joseph was sold to Egypt, the Ishmaelites from Midian, who carried him down there, were dealing in this balm. From that source of all truth, Wikipedia, I get this article on the balm of Gilead. By the way, these guys were coming down from Gilead. They were Ishmaelites who were from Midian, who had gone up to Gilead to get the stuff that they were going to travel to Egypt to sell. Okay, balm of Gilead is a balm, that's a healing compound, made from the resinous gum of the balsam poplar, Populus candacans, it's called, a North American tree species. Now, this is not the balm of Gilead that they went and got, because obviously they didn't get it from a North American tree. But they got it from a balsam tree just the same. It takes its name from the elusive biblical phrase balm in Gilead, referring to the balm or balsam carried from Gilead by the caravan of merchants to whom Joseph was sold by his brothers. That came from Wikipedia. Also, the herb's name derives from the ancient region in Gilead in Palestine, known for the great healing powers of its balm. Balm of Gilead is mentioned several times in Scripture, including Jeremiah 8:22. The writings of Pliny the Elder indicate that the tree was brought to Rome in the 1st century CE. The historian Josephus recorded that the Queen of Sheba made a gift of balm of Gilead to King Solomon. And they, that is Joseph's brothers, that's an edit, sat down to eat bread. And they lifted up their eyes and looked, and behold, a company of Ishmaelites came from Gilead with their camels bearing spicery and balm and myrrh, going to carry it down to Egypt. That's in Genesis 37:25. So Joseph's brothers carried down to him as a gift the exact same stuff the merchants took for sale to Egypt, plus some nuts and almonds. I doubt that the irony was lost on Joseph, and that it didn't affect his response to them and Benjamin. The honey was probably date syrup and not what we call honey, which is technically bee puke. Sorry, but it's true. This is about honey, and from, let's see, my source for this is Why is Honey Kosher? From Chabad.org. Pure honey is considered kosher even though it's produced by a flying insect, a non-kosher creature. Other products of non-kosher animals are non-kosher. From the article at Chabad.org, Why is Honey Kosher? I get this. Honey consists of nectar, which bees gather, store, and transport to the honeycombs. While in the bee, the nectar is broken down and transformed into honey by enzymes in the bee. But it's not actually digested by the bee, so the honey is not a product of the bee itself, as is milk. Now, to me, that's semantics. Honey is a product of the nectar and the enzymes from the bee, and the regurgitation of the product, and the fanning of that product to partially dehydrate it by the bees, and therefore the bees produce it. It's a product of the bees. But then, I'm not a rabbi, so I'll let it go at that. Verse 26 shows that the first complete fulfillment of Yosef's dream in 37:7, when all 11 of his brother's sheaves bowed down to his. Then in verse 28, they actually make obeisance to him. Obeisance is deferential courtesy or respect, like Obama in the presence of a Muslim monarch, without the drooling and the bootlicking. The Jacobson brothers' obeisance was in regard to the Egyptians' kindly inquiry for their father's life and health, I think. The stone's Tanakh has Yosef asking somewhat sarcastically if this is their little brother, their younger brother in the King James, who is now about 31 to 32 years old and has 11 children of his own, hardly a frail boy who couldn't make the trip last time, which was the implication of the brother's description of him. The Chumash gives the rabbi's impression that it was the resemblance to Rachel, to Rachel, in Benjamin that caused the emotions to well up in Yosef. They also think that Benjamin had told Yosef of his 10 children back in Canaan, all named in remembrance of his older brother Yosef, and that helped to draw the emotion from him as well. If true, how much he'd missed. Yosef went to another room to weep and to compose himself. That's interesting. The children are named, and I believe we get to see that in chapter 46. And each one of their names refers to something about Yosef. And so it's a very good possibility that that's what, you know, the Benjamin came and told him about his brother who was gone, but he remembers his brother by the names of his children. And that would make Yosef weep, I think. Okay, when he returned, Yosef's orders the food brought out. The steward had set 3 tables, one for Yosef alone, for his position would not allow him to eat with either the Hebrews or the help, one for the Egyptian servants and soldiers, and one for the Jacobsons. Notice I call them Jacobsons. that's what they are. In this, we can see the work of Mashiach in reconciling Yehuda and Yosef, and in setting a difference between Yisrael and the world. The steward had the Jacobsons seated in birth order, which surprised them. When the steward put 5 times the food in front of Benjamin as before any other, and that should have been a clue to the rest. 5 times the food, Elohim be gracious unto you, my son, as Yosef said to Benjamin. But for Hebrews, they were not too quick on the uptake. It went right over their heads. Okay, I'm going to stop there and open this to questions and comments on anything in chapter 43 that we've discussed. If you have a mic and you'd like to participate by voice, just raise your hand. I'll be happy to give you the mic. And if not, if you have a question or comment that you'd like answered or at least just to put before us, put it if you haven't got it. Hey, FT's bride, welcome in here, sis. That's my lovely bride there, FT's bride. Eve's Garden, you have a comment or a question, so here you may have the mic.
Okay, I think that it should transmit today, hopefully. Praise God. In verse 27 through 29, I saw something, and I have been thinking about it, and I don't understand it, so it's a question, an observation and a question. And it says in 26, actually, and when Joseph came home, they brought him the present which was in their hand into the house, and they bowed themselves to him to the earth. So we see that the brothers are bowed to the earth, and in 28 it says they bowed their heads and made obeisance. So you have them, I presume they're laying flat or bowing on the ground. But then in 29 it says the following, and he, Joseph, lifted up his eyes and saw his brother Benjamin, his mother's son. So if they're on the ground, then I presumed all 11 would be on the ground, including Benjamin, because that was the dream. It says he lifted up his eyes. And so I've been wondering, how could he lift up his eyes to see Benjamin? And I did a search on when other people lifted up their eyes and what they saw. And there's quite a few of them indeed, but I'm not certain what's being said there. What would cause him? What are your thoughts about that? Why did he lift up his eyes and see Benjamin if they were all prostrate on the ground? I'll release the mic.
It's a good question. First of all, Joseph is probably sitting on a dais up higher than all of them, and so lifting up his eyes is He's not lifting them up in relation to where he's sitting. He's lifting them up in relation to what he was looking at that particular time. I personally think that Benjamin was protected, buffered by his other brothers. He was as far away from Joseph as any of them, and so he was, you know, they were bowing to him. And he would have to lift up his eyes from, say, Reuben or Yehuda, who would be up front, being the leaders of the pack. And he would lift his eyes in relation to where they were. That's the only thing I can think of. I would expect that Benjamin was on the ground because it said, this is the first time that all 11 brothers are actually bowing to him. So it's that makes sense to me. Are there other questions or comments? That was a good observation, by the way, Eves. Thank you. Are there other questions or comments? If you haven't got a mic, you can type it into the text. All right, if not, we'll move on. Chapter 43. Or 44, rather. And verses 1 to 17. And he commanded the steward of his house, saying, fill the men's sacks with food, as much as they can carry, and put every man's money in his sack's mouth. And put my cup, the silver cup, in the sack's mouth of the youngest, and his corn money. And he did according to the word that Joseph had spoken. And as soon as the morning was light, the men were sent away, they and their asses. And when they were gone out of the city, and not yet far off, in other words, you could still see them, Joseph said unto his steward, up, follow after the men, and when thou dost overtake them, say unto them, wherefore have you rewarded evil for good? Is not this it in which my Lord drinketh, and thereby indeed he divineth? Ye have done evil in so doing. And he overtook them, and he spake unto them these same words. And they said unto him, wherefore saith my Lord these words? Elohim forbid that thy servants should do according to this thing. Behold, the money which we found in our sacks' mouths the last time, we brought again unto thee out of the land of Canaan. How then should we steal out of my thy Lord's house silver or gold? With whomsoever of thy servants it be found, both let him die, and we also will be my Lord's bondmen. And he said, Now also let it be according to your words. He with whom it is found shall be my servant, and ye shall be blameless. Then they speedily took down every man his sack to the ground, and opened every man his sack. And he searched, and began at the eldest, and left with the youngest. And the cup was found in Benjamin's sack. Then they rent their clothes, and laded every man his ass, and returned to the city. And Yehuda and his brethren came to Joseph's house, for he was yet there, and they fell before him on the ground. And Joseph said unto them, What deed is this that ye have done? Wot ye not that such a man as I can certainly divine? And Yehuda said, What shall we say unto my Lord? What shall we speak? For how shall we clear ourselves? Elohim hath found out the iniquity of thy servants. Behold, we are my Lord's servants, both we and he also with whom the cup is found. And he said, Joseph, Elohim forbid that I should do so, but the man in whose hand the cup is found, he shall be my servant, and as for you, get you up in peace unto your father. Ooh. Please don't go on, because next week we're going to get to see Yehuda be a man. Okay? But we're going to see that next week. Okay. Yosef had one last test for the Jacobsons. This test would tell him a lot about how the boys had matured or not over the years, and how far he could trust them. First, he pulled the same deal he did last year. I assume it was a full year, and this I certainly could be wrong. Could be. And that's, you will very seldom hear me say that I'm a I can't even say it now. But on this I could very well be wrong. The donkeys were laden with as much as they could safely carry, complete with their money sack back in their sacks. By this time, he had the steward put his silver goblet in Benjamin's sack. The way the King James reads, I think the steward may have put Benjamin's dough in the silver goblet in his feed sack's mouth. It's just the way that that's worded. It makes me think that. Joseph waited until they were just over the horizon when he sent the steward to catch them and spring the surprise on them. Or actually, probably just this side of the horizon. And they answer, What are you, nuts? I'm sorry. The steward asks, What are you, nuts? In a marked paraphrase. Couldn't you have chosen a slightly less conspicuous thing to steal? Like maybe his chariot? Did you think he wouldn't miss his favorite coffee mug? Especially first thing in the morning, you know? That's my paraphrase. Well, none stood up as leader out there, all of them protesting their innocence. Had they not come back with the money they'd found in their sacks, and the money to buy again, had they not brought their brother to prove their worth as men? Then they said the fatal words of verse 9. With whomsoever of thy servants it be found, let him die, and we also will be my Lord's bondmen. The steward, knowing the score already, says, As you say. They started with Reuben and worked their way down to Benjamin, where the cup was stashed. Can you imagine what went through the brothers' minds then? The more larcenous of them probably thought, You stupid kid! And the most righteous of them probably thought, You stupid kid! Meanwhile, Benjamin's eyes had to be like saucers. How the heck did that get in there? Now imagine the return to Sukkot. The trip had taken less than an hour on the way out, but it must have felt like days going back. And they had pronounced their own doom. Notice also that beginning with the return back, Yehuda was back in the leadership role. Last couple of weeks, I've made it a point to tell you to offer government officials nothing more than what they ask. When civil authority asks you a question, answer truthfully exactly what they ask and no more. In this world, government's job is to part you from two things, your property and your liberty. Do not tell them by running off at the mouth, or help them, rather, by running off at the mouth, because that is how they part you from what is yours. If you are being detained for any reason, even a traffic violation, assume that it is investigatory, that they're looking for something to incriminate you. You have the right to remain silent. Do so. You answer questions truthfully, exactly what they ask, and no more. Okay? Now, the steward had said, no. Just the one with whom it was found will be my servant. Now, do you get that? The steward has done this to the, listen to what he's done for the Jacobsons. Okay? He brought everything they needed, washed their feet, housed and fed their animals, had at last overseen the preparation of the food, or at least overseen the preparation of the food, probably given them all overnight lodging, and he'd prepared in Yosef's house while they were partying down. Now Binyamin was going to be doing all the work for the servant of Yosef, see, because this is going to be his servant. When they got back to Yosef's house, he verbally slaps them around. What, are you nuts? Couldn't you have stolen something a little less conspicuous, like my chariot? Did you think that I'd not miss my favorite coffee mug first thing in the morning? Yehuda says to Yosef, what can we say? How can we clear ourselves? The goblet was found in my little brother's grain sack. None of us knows how, but those are the facts. It must be judgment from Elohim, for he has discovered our iniquity, and this is our punishment. So we are all your servants. In saying this, I think Yehuda is trying to save his brothers and himself from returning to Yaakov's mourning. But Yosef says, no, that wouldn't be right. I'll just keep the guilty party with me and let you all go back home. So Yosef is fulfilling Torah in this, for the soul that sinneth, it shall die, in Exodus chapter 18, verse 4 and 20. Yehuda knew that the loss of Benjamin would kill their father, and didn't want that to happen, because it was his idea to sell Yosef into slavery, and got this whole thing started. Ultimately, it was his fault that his father would grieve himself to death. Okay? And that's why Yehuda is trying to mollify it, and trying to keep it so that they don't have to go back. Well, we'll see more on this next week. We're going to see Yosef, or Yehuda, really step to the plate next week. Are there other questions? Are there questions or comments on any of the Torah portion for today? What is the meaning of them rending their clothes? When the rent means to tear, okay, and that's a sign of mourning in the Middle Eastern culture. It's the gnashing of teeth. Depending on how bad it would get, they would even pull out the hair of their beards. Things like that to show that they're in deep mourning. That's what rending the clothes is all about. Other questions or comments? Mark is animating this morning. Thank you very much. Was it good? Patty by Grace, you have a question or a comment? Oh, Eve's Garden's got a comment. I'll give her the mic. And Patty by Grace, if you've got something to say, raise your hand, man.
In this particular chapter, I find some parallels between what's happening here and what happened with Rachel and Laban's idols. And at first, I never really noticed it, but it seems to me that Joseph has set up not just something to test them, but he's using what happened in the past almost. Because, let me show you, I think he used some strategy to test them. So in this chapter, it says, here's what the response is. He put this stolen cup into the sack. And it seems, and here was the response, with whomsoever of thy servants it be found, both let him die, and we also will be my Lord's bondmen. I don't think that they believe that anybody would have stolen it, so I think they were willingly saying that. But he says, let him die. And I think that what's happening here is that Judah took the example with Joseph, with his father, Jacob and Laban, and he did when Rachel had stole the golden idol. Because look here back in Genesis 31, here was the words of Jacob, "With whom thou findest thy gods, let him not live." And so it seems to me that Joseph has taken this particular test, and he's also applying it to them, and they're responding in a very similar to manner to what their fathers did. So you see, it's almost a play on what happened before with Rachel, and he's doing it with Benjamin. So I don't know if that's accurate or not. I just see some strong similarities. Patty, your mic.
I just went through this portion of Torah here a while back. This is a great study. Listen, FT, I got something to say. It's not related to the study. If you want, I'll save it until after. I'll make a note. Well, no, it's got nothing to do with this. It's got something to do with everything else, but it's kind of a praise in a way, and I just wanted to share it, but I'll save it until after we're done. Go ahead.
Yeah, I appreciate that, Patty. We may cover something like it in the rest of the Midrash. So if we get something close, jump on it, okay? Yeah. But if not, I'm sure that we'll have some time afterwards, and I'll stay and answer questions for a while. So, are there other questions or comments on the Torah portion? By the way, thank you, Eve's Garden. That was a very good observation. I see the connection between this particular action of Yosef and Rachel, and taking the idols of her father. That's good. I'm sure they all knew all about that. And I think that the reason that Rachel died in childbirth with Benjamin at a young age was because she had taken her father's idol and was attached to it for whatever reason. So, I don't know that he was actually used a divining cup, Gadel. I'm not certain of that at all. Yes, he was a follower of Jehovah, so I don't think he did. I think that he just used that as a pretense to bring his brothers back, or to bring at least Benjamin back. Okay? It was something to hold over them, and I really think it was so that he could check on the brothers' character. How it had changed over the 22 years since he'd seen them. He'd already seen a glimpse of it in Yehuda. Okay? Now, is he going to get the same glimpse out of all of them? I think that's what the whole point was. Eve's Garden, you may have the mic back.
I'd like to just further elaborate on Joseph knew what there was, almost as if he anticipated the response would be to kill the one who took it. So thereby, when he set the plan in place to test them, he knew how they would respond. At least that's the appearance that it gives. And so that's the way he would ultimately test to see if they had repented. Because had they just... it's clear if he knew and understood, like you said, and all the brothers would have known, that's how their father had dealt with this same issue. I suspect they would have responded exactly like they did, and Joseph probably did too. And so he knew exactly what position he was putting them into, that they would respond exactly like the father, and then they would have to make a choice whether or not they were prepared to give Benjamin up. So it was just a... He's almost sort of cunningly brilliant in that he almost knows what's going to play out. He does know, actually, I suspect. And so that's why we see this test to prove that there's been such a great change. And, that's an interesting question you ask, Gadel, about the divining cup. I've heard that taught, that it's a divining cup, but I don't know anywhere that's really said in the Word of God. Is it ever said anywhere that's a divining cup, or is that just oral tradition. Clearly, he has a cup. You know, in Genesis 40, Pharaoh had a cup. And, but I don't know if that's oral tradition or if it's really established in the Word of God that that cup was used for divining. I think that might be an urban legend or maybe rabbinic tradition. I'm not certain. I release the mic.
Thank you, Eves. Actually, in the text, it does say that he uses it. Do I not use this for divining? Okay. Did you not know that such a one as I could divine? And the servant says that's the cup by which he divines. I really don't believe that he did, okay, use it for divining. I believe that he was in contact with Yehovah. I'm sure that they were intimate, and so he didn't need to have some outward thing so that he could divine with. However, he was in a position. In a pagan, in a leadership position in a pagan country, and so it's very possible that he had been given this cup that was a divining cup. Maybe it had been Pharaoh's divining cup, and so he had this thing, and you know, it may have been a piece of something that showed his rank in the country. You know what I mean? So. I don't know for certain about this. I'm just thinking out loud, really. But there's a possibility that it actually was a divining cup that someone had used for divining before, but Yosef didn't use it for that. He had the spirit of Elohim in him. He didn't need that thing, you know. So that's what I think, anyway. Maybe he was just trying to get rid of it. It's possible. Anyway, that's what I think. So, Eves, you have another comment? Please take the mic.
Actually, I just have another train of thought regarding the divining cup, and sorry about my error there. Two questions. It could be, like you say, that it could have been somebody else's, and the servant, although it seems to me the servant recognizes who Yahweh is, I would imagine Joseph had been teaching him, but I agree also that he was probably, like you said, loyal and probably had been taught. But he could be calling it just by its name because that's what it was used amongst the Egyptians. But you know, another thought comes to mind that's worthy of asking. I don't know if I've ever looked at this, but nothing comes to mind. I wonder if. Here's the question. When Joseph was in Egypt for a very long time, I wonder if he did partake or take on any of the Egyptian practices. It never crossed my mind to even ask that or think that before. But after being in a pagan culture for such a long time, you know, I think about ourselves, we eventually start to assimilate and begin to take on some of those pagan ways. I wonder if Joseph stayed absolutely pure of that, or if he may have actually, you know, accepted or in some way practiced some of them. It might actually be that case. I mean, that's the way life is at times when you're assimilated into a nation. So that would be the question I'd ask. If there's any other indication anywhere that indicates that Joseph may have done or assimilated into any of their practices other than this one. I release the mic.
Well, we have another example of what Eve was just expounding on in Elijah's life when Naaman came from Assyria, and he was... He was converted by the actions of Yehovah in his cleansing of leprosy, and he said, "I will never bow to another god except for your Yehovah, and I want to take some dirt from here so that I can set up an altar to him." You know, it's a very good possibility that Yosef did that kind of thing because he was. Kind of had to. Remember, Naaman said, "Don't hold it against me when I have to go in with my with my master, the king, into the house of Nisroch. Okay? I think it was Nisroch or Tisroch or something like that. Something like that. One of those words that C.S. Lewis used to base his Narnia books on. But it's a... I'm just thinking it's that's a good possibility that he had to go into the houses of the Egyptian gods as a servant in Pharaoh's court or in Potiphar's court. It's possible. And so, you know, and in his position that he was in, he might have had to do that with Pharaoh. That doesn't mean that he was worshiping those gods, but he had to go into that thing. And so that's a good possibility. Closest emoticon to an egg is what, a pizza? Come on, man. Anyway, are there other questions or comments? Yehezkel, it's a good possibility. Maybe he didn't want the people to know where his gift came from, and they assumed that he used that thing as a divining cup. It's a possibility, too. But I also agree with Eves that probably Yosef was teaching this guy, his steward, and possibly he was teaching him the ways of Yah. And, you know, my own personal anyway. Pizza. Oh, we had pizza last night. It was good. Anyway, other questions or comments on the Torah portion? You guys are a lot of fun. Any other questions or comments on the Torah portion? Could it be that Rachel died young because of not being satisfied with her own son? She wanted more and her body failed her? I suppose there's a possibility there, but that would be... it's a possibility. It's a possibility. I like to make allusion to what's actually in the scripture, but that is a possibility. That's what, you know, she died on the road to Bethlehem, and she was outside of the town, you know, when it happened. So, I mean, anyway, other questions or comments? If not, we shall move on. We have the Haftarah coming up, and that's going to be Jeremiah chapter 42, verses 12 through 17. And then we'll stop and comment on that, and then we'll read the other portion of the Haftarah and comment on that, and then we'll open it for questions and comments. Jeremiah chapter 42, and verses 12 through 17. And they go like... By the way, let me set this up a little bit. In chapter 41 sets up the action and the prophecy in chapter 42. In verses 1 through 3, the leaders of the group who are thinking of going down to Egypt ask Yirmiyahu to inquire of Yehovah Elohecha. Okay? They said, ask Yehovah your God. Not Yehovah Elhenu, our God. And in verses 5 and 6, they agree to do whatever Yehovah tells them that they should do. Okay, so what we have here is a reenactment of Sinai. 10 days later, the word of Yehovah came to Yirmiyahu, and he went to speak it in their hearing. And Yehovah promised in verses 9 through 12 that if they would stay in Haaretz, that he would bless them and protect them, that they need not fear Babylon. And that's where we're at when we start reading here. And verse 12. And I will show mercies unto you, that he may have mercy upon you, that is the king of Babylon, and cause you to return to your own land. But if you say, we will not dwell in this land, neither obey the voice of Yehovah Elohecha, saying no, but we will go into the land of Egypt, where we shall see no war, nor hear the sound of the trumpet, nor have hunger of bread, and there will we dwell, And now, therefore, hear the word of Yehovah, ye remnant of Yehuda. Thus saith Yehovah Tzevaot, the Elohim of Israel. If ye wholly set your faces to enter into Egypt, and go to sojourn there, then it shall come to pass that the sword, which ye feared, shall overtake you there in the land of Egypt. And the famine, whereof ye are afraid, shall follow close after you there in Egypt, and there ye shall die. So shall it be with all the men that set their face to go into Egypt to sojourn there. They shall die by the sword, by the famine, and by the pestilence, and none of them shall remain or escape from the evil that I bring upon them. Okay? That's the curse that Yehovah pronounces on them if they don't follow. Okay, so here we go. The first verse of our portion is the last word of Yehovah's blessing to them. He will show them mercy as he has and always wanted to do, and that he would do so through the king of Babylon, if they would just obey him as they promised they would. He would cause the king of Babylon to allow them to return to their own land. What he asks. Then, in verse 13, he tells them what will happen if they renege on their promise, and he starts the sentence with but. That is a conjunction of negation. But means exactly the opposite. Remember what I've just promised you as a blessing. If you decide not to accept the blessing, man, you're going to get exactly the opposite. He told them now, or how he would bless their obedience, and then he told them how he would judge their intransigence and rebellion. A marked paraphrase goes like this. If you decide to do your will instead of mine, especially after you asked me for it and said you'd obey it, here's what I'll do to you. The sword that you fear will follow on your heels and find you there. The famine that you fear will follow close on your heels, and you will die of the famine, those who do not die by the sword. And I'll add pestilence that follows hard on the heels of the sword and the famine. It's up to you. Choose wisely. Do you think they shamad? Not on your life, or more importantly, not on their lives. Now, we're all people who have made it our goal to do what Yehovah has told us to do. We have told him that we will obey his word for us. Now we are on the verge of Babylon conquering our land, here in America and truly everywhere else in the world. Many of us are fleeing because we're taking literally, come out of her, my people. I have a friend who has coined an expression. Many have taken spiritually that which Yehovah means to be taken literally, and have taken literally that which he means to be taken spiritually. Generally, he's speaking of your average Christian when he talks like that. The question we need to ask is this. Where in the world will we be able to escape the New World Order, the anti-Messiah system? Is this Haftarah something that we need to heed? Did Yehovah not promise to set up his remnant of Judah in their own place, land in a place like Goshen, where he could keep them set apart unto him and bless them and their work? Where is his Goshen going to be? Was not Goshen set apart unto Israel in Egypt? Okay. That's what I have for Jeremiah. Now we'll move on to First Kings. And it's only one verse. Although you can bet that my comment isn't. First Kings chapter 3 and verse 15. Where it says, and Shlomo awoke, and behold, it was a dream. And he came to Jerusalem and stood before the Ark of the Covenant of Yehovah, and offered up burnt offerings, and offered peace offerings, and made a feast to all his servants. Shlomo had just become king after the death of David, and had just had a personal chat with Yehovah in his dream, and was told that he would be given wisdom like none else had ever had due to the nature and heart of his request before Yehovah. I seriously doubt that he chose that time to breach Torah by going into the holiest and stand before the Ark of Yehovah and also do the offerings himself. He was not in usurpation mode. or a priestly duties mode, but he was in full humility and thanksgiving mode. The temple was not built yet, and the tabernacle was in Gibeon. He brought the animals to offer and gave them to the priest to actually offer them. This is why he was in Gibeon. He went up to that high place in Gibeon, and that's where the tabernacle was at that time. Although David had brought the ark into Jerusalem and set it up in a tent of its own. Brought the animals to offer and gave them to the priest to actually offer them. And standing before the altar, which was outside of the tabernacle sanctuary, he was standing before the ark of Yehovah, which was only a few cubits. I got this all mistaken. I'm sorry. He's not in Gibeon. He can't be, because it says that he's in Jerusalem. So he must be in Jerusalem, and the tabernacle must be there. And so please, I caught that one. You don't have to. Especially if the Shekinah was still present. So here he is. He was in Gibeon, and he has traveled to Jerusalem in order to make the offering. Okay? And he's standing before the altar, which is just outside of the tabernacle. And so, although he is not in the tabernacle and he's not making the offering himself, he is standing before the Shekinah, who is on the mercy seat, which is on the ark. Okay, so let's put these two passages together. The pilgrims who came to America, the two passages of the Haftarah, the pilgrims who came to America from England and Holland believed that they were leaving Babylon and Egypt and coming to the land of promise. That was in 1620. Are we not very nearly exactly as far removed from them in time as Yirmiyahu was from Shlomo, about 380 to 390 years? What I am not saying is that if Yehovah is moving you to leave, you shouldn't. You need to do what Yehovah is telling you to do. What I am saying is that he's done this before and given a remnant of his people an opportunity to obey him fully and not go ahead of him in their own strength, even while Babylon was ruling that part of the world. I think that he wanted to leave a righteous remnant to keep the land viable while the rebellious majority was in exile, and against the day of their return. When these men rebelled and went into Egypt for safety, they left Yehovah's land to the Samaritans and made it that much more difficult for the returning remnant to settle back in Haaretz. I am saying, wait on Ruach of Yehovah and his leading before you go on your wilderness camping trip. He may have blessings for you right where you are if he wants you there. He also might have blessings for you where he wants you to go. That's why you need to know, you need to discern what it is that Yehovah has for you to do. And that's something that only you and he can do. It's not something, you can't ask me, should I go or should I stay, because I don't know. Okay? That's not on me. That's on you. You need to be in touch with Yehovah on that. Okay? So, open the questions and comments, and Eve's Garden has her hand up. You may have the mic.
Right, I agree with you, Mark, about if you tie this to the Jeremiah passage to the Genesis passage, it seems to me that it's very clear that God placed his people where he needed to place them or where he chose to place them. And it becomes real clear in Jeremiah that God wants his people in Babylon. And he tells them to build houses and have homes there and families. And as a matter of fact, if they don't stay where he's placed them, he tells them that they'll die. And then there in Jeremiah, it's very clear, this portion about being put in Egypt to be saved and be put in Babylon to be spared, it becomes very clear, at least in my eyes, that he uses the nations to put his people for whatever reason. And then in Jeremiah, it says he will deliver them. So I think that, and I'm in agreement that until God puts upon your heart and convicts you that you're to leave to go to a certain place. And then even when he does that, it's so difficult to know if it's really him, in my opinion. But seek his will for our lives. But it says he will deliver us. He was going to deliver the people from Babylon, and we know that he delivered them from Egypt as well. So it's paramount, in my opinion, not to leave where he places us until such time as he delivers us from that place, or he gives us other directions personally, not to rely upon God to give us that direction, because admonishes the house of Judah that if you don't go into Babylon, then you're going to die, and he gives the promise that he's the one that will deliver them as well. And that's sort of where I believe we are right now in time. We are still scattered into the nations in Babylon, and he promises he will deliver us. So it's a matter of just waiting for his promise to be fulfilled. And I just really believe when it's time for me to move, I will know it, and I won't have any doubt, and I'll know that it's God. He'll prove himself to the fact that it's him delivering us, so I won't have to worry about when it's time to go. Release the mic to Vic Taylor.
Thanks, Steve. I just want to point out, I thought I heard Mark say that there's a possibility that people should go back to the land of Palestine, or what is called today modern Israel. And I just want to point out in Revelation that modern Israel, that land there, that city, is called spiritually Sodom and Egypt. In Revelation chapter 11 of Revelation, verses 8. And so I'm just wondering if during the end time, is God going to keep us safe? Does he have to place us in some geographical area to keep us safe? I'm just wondering if that's his agenda, to take us from one geographical location so they keep us safe in another geographical location. Couldn't he save us where we are, wherever we are, and we don't have to flee? Unless you're in Judea at the time, maybe you should, or you should flee if you're in that area in the land of Palestine around Jerusalem. Maybe you should flee then. But anyway, I yield the mic.
Yes, points well taken. I did not mean that we should run off to Israel. That's, wherever Yehovah tells you to go, that's where you ought to go. We have friends who have moved to Ecuador, okay? We have other friends who have moved to Costa Rica. We have other friends who have moved to Bolivia. These are places where Yehovah has led them, okay? For whatever reason, that's if they're convinced that that's where Yehovah wants them, and I'm not anyone who can tell them any different. Okay, Yehovah has not told me to leave this area yet. You know, that may come. You know, but right now, Ohio is where I'm supposed to be, and this the area where I live, especially, is where I'm supposed to be. Now, personally, I believe that he's going to cause some cataclysmic upheavals of the earth, and he's going to separate the eastern part of the country from the western part of the country when we do the separation of the land, when we force the separation of the land of Israel. That's what I personally believe is going to happen. I could be wrong, but that's what I think. There are prophecies among many people, Christian, Messianic, and others, who believe that they see the Great Lakes emptying into the Gulf of Mexico via the Mississippi Valley. And that will run from somewhere just west of Cleveland over across Indiana and Illinois to the Mississippi and then down. And there is a fault line that runs right up there. And he might just use it. He just might do it. So, but he has me in a place that's going to be safe from that. Okay? I'll end up being on the eastern part of the continent that gets ripped off. know, and other people will be on the western part. But whatever. I see the possibility of that happening. But he hasn't told me to go anywhere yet. So I'm sitting here waiting, and I'm waiting for him to tell me, you may go or you may stay. Until he tells me to go, I'm staying put. Okay? That may be different for other people. Like the New Madrid Fault Line, exactly. That's what I'm talking about, Patty. Okay, Patty, you have a question or a comment. You may have the mic, and then Vic, you take it right from him.
I'm in agreement with you, Mark, on this. Yah has not told me to move anywhere. For a while there, I got into the, you know, survivalist type of thing and arming myself up with every kind of firearm you can think of, from a 22 Derringer to a nuclear bomb. Nah, I'm just kidding about the bomb. But, you know, and I'm trying to think, well, I'll dig underground. No, there's going to be earthquakes. Well, I'll go to a mountaintop. No, there could be, you know, you could go crazy with this. Let it go. Wait upon Yah for this. So, just recently, I ended up outside of the city that I was living in. Yeah, exactly. And I'm about 24 miles away. And people are telling me, well, you're safe now. No, you're not. You're not. Because those people in the city are going to take about 2-3 weeks to eat up all the food there, and then they're going to come out to the country. So I got about 2-3 weeks. I hope I can dig a deep enough hole and cover up with. Because, it, you know what? I just gave it up to Yah. I'm not going to worry about it. Yeah, it probably won't, Sword. It probably won't. I gave myself that much just to make myself feel good. Don't worry about it. You know, because ultimately, what's going to happen? You know, you're going to die. Oh, you're going to die, you're going to happen, you're going to go to heaven. I don't see any downside in that one. I'm not going to worry about it. I'll leave it in his hands. If he wants me to pick up and take off and go to some mountaintop or some deep canyon or into the cave, he'll tell me. But I'm not going to worry about it anymore. You know what? I sold a lot of those guns. I keep a few for just personal protection and for hunting. That's all I need. I'm not going to go to war with the United States government, okay? You just can't do that. You mean to tell me that one person can take on the entire United States government and win? I don't think so. I don't think so. When you consider everything that they've got, you know, and who knows, the United States government may turn, the army may turn against the government. We may have a coup here. Maybe China might get really angry and just pepper us with nuclear bombs. I don't know. I'm not going to worry about it. I'm going to follow Yah. I'm going to study his word. And I'm going to keep doing what I've been told to do. Spread the gospel. Reach out to the least of these in any way that I can. Theodore Herzl? I don't know that person. Yeah, literally. Servant. Just wait a minute. Don't go running off to the mountaintop. Not yet, anyway. Like I said, I told my wife that I'm thinking that Yah wants me to go to Hawaii. I told her that I was going to go pack, or I told her to go pack while I prayed about it. Vic, your mic.
Patty, you're funny, man. You're funny. Anyway, I'm not worried. Personally, I'm not worried. I'm not worried about moving or doing anything like that. And I'll leave it, my life, in the hands of the Creator God, Yahweh. I just want to make this one quick comment. I smiled when I heard Fulfilling saying he heard somebody went to Bolivia. Now they're down in different parts of South America. And I'm reminded of Bush and many other of the power brokers, criminal power brokers. They've bought huge tracts of land in Paraguay and other various parts of South America. So I don't know. You're going to flee to South America thinking you're going to get saved? And anyway, I just thought of that. I thought about the Bushes and some other power broker elite families buying up large tracts of land in South America, because they know some definite rotten stuff is coming down the pike for United States and the Western nations. Anyway, I yield the mic. Thank you.
Here's what the New Testament says that's of interest to me. And Mark, it also says it in Matthew, a similar comment. And then shall they see the Son of Man coming in the clouds with great power and glory. And then shall he send his angels and shall gather together his elect from the four winds, from the uttermost part of the earth to the uttermost part of heaven. So when he's coming, whether his angels be angels of heaven or messengers, men or both, those group of people are going to gather together the elect. And the elect are still in four winds at all the other uttermost parts of the earth. So at the time of his coming, all the elect is not in Israel or is not in some great mountaintop even at his coming, because it's at his coming that he's gathering them all together, and they're scattered everywhere until that point. Now, it doesn't mean that some won't go places, some won't go to Israel, some people will go, you know, wherever God has a plan for them, needs them to be, to help the other people there. But God wants as many saved and in the kingdom as possible, so he's going to leave his elect throughout the world, and that's what the testimony is in the New Testament. Not until the point of his return, when we see him coming in the clouds, are the in totality of his children, all the elect, regathered. And that's how I know that not everybody will all be in one place, because it's told to me in the New Testament that they're still even in the uttermost part of the earth. Now, I suppose we could take that to mean in that they're dead and they're in the graves in uttermost part of the earth, but I take that to be living and dead that are gathered together at that point it is coming. I release the mic.
Excellent comments. Excellent comments from all of you. Very good stuff. Let's see. Looking at the text. Are there any questions in there? Paraguayans speak Spanish, I believe. I believe only Brazil speaks Portuguese. Everything else is Spanish. Okay. Okay, I don't see any questions or comments in the text. So, we'll move on to the Psalm. Psalm 37. 24 verses in that psalm. And we'll begin as soon as I can get the darn thing up here. Where are you? Psalm 37. Fret not thyself because of evildoers, neither be thou envious against the workers of iniquity, for they shall soon be cut down like the grass, and wither as the green herb. Trust in Jehovah and do good, so shalt thou dwell in the land, and verily thou shalt be fed. Delight thyself also in Jehovah, and he shall give thee the desires of thine heart. Commit thy way unto Jehovah, trust also in him, and he shall bring it to pass. And he shall bring forth a righteousness, thy righteousness as the light, and thy judgment as the noonday. Rest in Jehovah, and wait patiently on him. Fret not thyself because of him who prospereth in his way, because of the man who bringeth wicked devices to pass. Cease from anger, and forsake wrath. Fret not thyself in any wise to do evil, for evildoers shall be cut off from those that wait upon Jehovah, they shall inherit the earth. Nor yet a little while, I'm sorry, for yet a little while, and the wicked shall not be. Yea, thou shalt diligently consider his place, and it shall not be. But the meek shall inherit the earth, and shall delight themselves in the abundance of peace. The wicked plotteth against the just, and gnasheth upon him with his teeth. Hang on a minute. We'll take this through verse 17 for now. The Lord shall, I'm sorry, yeah, well, yeah, it says Adonai shall laugh at him, for he seeth that his day is coming. The wicked have drawn out the sword, and have bent their bow, and cast down the poor and the needy, and to slay such as be of an upright conversation. Their sword shall enter into their own heart, and their bows shall be broken. A little that a righteous man hath is better than the riches of many wicked. For the arms of the wicked shall be broken, but Jehovah upholdeth the righteous. Jehovah knoweth the days of the upright, and their inheritance shall be forever. Okay. This psalm is an instruction book for living in the time of Yaakov's trouble. There are five times that the psalmist uses the phrase, Yirshu Aretz, inherit the earth or inherit the land, in verses 9, 11, 22, 29, and 34. Inheriting Haaretz is a gracious provision from Yehovah. Five times he tells us about it. So it's his gracious provision. Twice he says that dwell in the land, and twice he refers to inheritance. So nine times he's talking about us inheriting the land, either the native-born or the engrafted Israelite. Now, do you see how verses 1 through 3 of our psalm tie directly to our Haftarah in Yirmiyahu? Don't worry if Yehovah's Spirit has not called you out of this land. Stay where He wants you to be, or go where He wants you to go. Just stay in His will and follow His lead. Don't let iniquitous men dictate how you relate to Yehovah. And iniquitous men may sound all spiritual and Torah observant. Just because you've been called to go doesn't mean everyone else has to go. And just because you've been called to stay doesn't mean that everyone else has been called to stay. Each must follow Yehovah as Yehovah calls him, and not necessarily as Yehovah calls his neighbor. You trust Yehovah and obey him, and you will dwell in the land and truly be fed. That sounds like both physically and spiritually fed to me. Now look at all the instructions that we're given in the first 7 to 8 verses. We are told to trust in, delight in, commit our way to, rest in Yehovah. To trust Him is to obey Him, as it says in the first verse where it says, trust in Yehovah. To delight in Him is to want your heart to be like His, and so to have all the desires of your heart. If your heart is like Yehovah's, if you're going after what He wants you to go after, then all of the desires of your heart are going to be the same desires that He has. And so, you'll have the desires of your heart. You'll be in His will. To commit your way to Him is to trust Him to bring it to pass, to bring forth your righteousness and your judgment into the light of day. To rest in Yehovah is to wait for His leading, and then follow it in His time. For those who wait on Him, Yirshu Aretz, those who wait on Him inherit the land. Yehovah will protect us in that time if we trust Him enough to do as He says. He promised those Yehudim to protect them if they'd obey like they promised in Jeremiah chapter 42. When they refused, He let them have their desires: death by sword, famine, and disease. After all, He told them, if you don't do this, this is what's going to happen. So they must have wanted it, because they decided not to follow Him. When they refused, He gave them their desires: death by sword, famine, and disease. He'll always give us the desires of our heart. And we prove what those desires are by our trust in His Word. Verses 11 through 19, Yeshua quoted this verse, when he said, "Blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the land." That's verse 11. But who else inherits the land? Those who wait on Yehovah inherit the land in verse 9. The righteous inherit the land in verse 29. Those who are blessed inherit the land in verse 22. All those are those descriptions are all interchangeable for those who are meek, are the blessed of Yehovah, because they are righteous and obedient and they wait on Yehovah. And we'll see the inheritance in its fullness when the wicked are vanquished. We have the personal initial, spiritual fulfillment of this promise in the Olam Hazeh, right here, right now. We'll see the intermediate physical inheritance in the millennial kingdom. And we'll see the ultimate inheritance in the Olam Haba, the world to come. Verses 12 through 17 remind me of Psalm 2, 1 through 5. The wicked think they're all that in a bag of chips, when they are nothing in the presence of Yehovah Tzevaot. If they can do anything in his presence beside cower in fear, they're going to look just silly. Can you imagine them not cowering in fear before Yehovah and drawing their sword to protect themselves from him? That is just going to be silly. And that's the way they're going to look. Everything they do to try to show their independence of Yehovah will turn around and bite their backsides. That's what's called the law of unintended consequences. Gee, we didn't mean to throw the world into a deep freeze and kill off whole regions of agriculture with aluminum chaff in those chemtrails. All we wanted to do was to slow the effects of global warming. Well, look what we've got in the Northern Hemisphere. The whole place is just in a deep freeze. You know that Deepwater Horizon that went off in April, you know, down in the Gulf? The thing blew up and it exploded and there's oil everywhere, and they came in and they dropped the dispersant, and now the oil is all down under the water where you can't see it anymore, but it's still causing all kinds of havoc. What the havoc is that it's causing? It completely destroyed the Gulf Loop, which is a current in the Gulf between, or, you know, under, you know, around the Florida Peninsula, over towards New Orleans. It just rolls around and around and around. And some of it goes around the south of Florida, and some of it keeps going around to the west. Some of it goes around the south of Florida and creates the Gulf Stream, right? Well, the Gulf Stream is dead. The Gulf Stream is virtually non-existent at this point. And so there's no warm water going up to the North Sea and England, and now England and Northern Europe are in a deep freeze like they haven't experienced in a lot of years. Okay? All because we decided to do things in our own way. Okay? We Americans, I should say. Okay, so all of that to help global warming, right? Whenever humanity tries to outsmart Yehovah, he gives them the desires of their hearts, usually in spades. But take heart, you meek and upright, because your inheritance is Le'olam Tihyeh, to the world that will be. You will not be ashamed, nor will you suffer in any famine. If you're following after him, he will make sure that you do not suffer in any famine. I'm open to questions and comments up to verse 19. Patty, by grace, you got that hand up quick, man. You were waiting. Get on it. You may have the mic.
You're right. I had my cursor right over the raise hand button waiting for you. I just wanted to comment on everything you brought out. Well, I can't comment on everything because I can't even remember that much. But when you brought up that thing about the New Madrid and the Great Lakes thing, you know, I've heard this theory so many times, and I'm actually sitting here waiting for it to happen. The minute they divide the city of God, I might have to say ice skates there, Eve. Yeah, you know, we can always do the old run and slide thing. Remember that? The run and slide? When you were a kid, you'd get up some thing and you'd hit the ice flat-footed and go for about 20, 30 feet. I'd love to do that. And I had heard, one thing I'd like to ask you about, Mark, is I had heard about the Gulf Stream stalling. And I didn't know if that had actually happened. But if it must have, it would explain what is going on in Europe right now. I just posted an article yesterday on Facebook about, I think it was yesterday or the day before, about how England's in a mini ice age right now and will probably go on for the next 10 to 15 years. Followed immediately by the repeal of DADT. Exactly. Exactly. Every time. And those of you who haven't read it, there's a book out there by Walter, not Walter. Where's the book? It's called, I can't even remember. Help me. I can't remember. It's written by the guy Koenig of Koenig News Service. Y'all remember who I'm talking about? I don't. I can't. Let's face it. When you start getting older, two things happen. One, you first start to forget a lot of things, and I don't remember what the other one is, so forget about it. He talks about the relationship between things that God does in, or mankind does, and how God responds. And we made them give up the Gaza. Look what happened. Katrina. That night. Obama went to the UN and started saying that they would no longer stand 100% positive with Israel anymore. Bang. Bill Koenig. Eye to eye. Thank you, Trib. I've got the book laying over there on the bookshelf, and I can't see it from here because I don't have my glasses either. I'm only good up close and personal. Well, there's one that needs to be ignored. The point is that every time in these end times, and I know we're in them, we do something, it's going to have a direct effect. They're talking about dividing the city of God. They're talking about dividing the city of God. And America's deep in it. So when Mark brought up the thing about the New Madrid and the waters flowing down into the Gulf, I went, oh yeah, that would be for real. That would be for real. I'm actually sitting here in awe of the things that God has done recently. Actually sitting here in awe. And thanks for bringing all this up again, Mark, because it really helps. And in relating this to the scripture, too, because we're seeing it happen day to day. Everything. And, I was going to bring something up, but I said I'd wait until after the study. Go ahead.
Okay, yeah, you've... The only reason that I know anything about the Gulf Stream being dead is because I read an article about it in a European paper on the internet. It was from a European paper, I can't remember which one. About the Gulf Stream being non-existent right now. It was like dead. And I posted that on my Facebook page a week and a half, 2 weeks ago. So, you know, you can probably find it there. I don't think it was Der Spiegel because I don't actually read German. But but it was a European English paper. I think it was a Telegraph or something like that from London. But yeah, I read about that being the cause of the cold weather that they're having in England. I mean, they're having a terrible, terrible winter, and winter only just began 4 days ago. You know, but for the last 3 weeks they've been having. My future daughter-in-law is in Germany, and she posted on her Facebook that they had. She said, "Wir haben viel Schnee." You know, which means we're having lots of snow. And so I asked her, wie viel Schnee ist viel Schnee? And she writes back, lots, like 2 feet, you know? Now, she's only 5 feet tall, so I, 5 foot two. So I asked her, did you have to stand on tippy toes to see over that? And she kind of laughed. But anyway, they got 2 feet of snow there. You know, that's over her knee. You know, we're not used to seeing that kind of snow in this part of the world. And they're not used to seeing it either this early. They may see that kind of thing in January. But, you know, we're getting January weather in December. And it all has to do with us trying to mess with Yehovah's order in whatever way we're trying to mess with it. It's not us, you know, you and me that are listening, but us as in the men. Pagan men who are running the world. Those people are messing with Yehovah's order. And he's letting us have the consequences of it. So, that's how I see what's going on. Lost Jester, you have your hand up. You may have the mic.
Well, I don't usually speak because I'm a little... little new to this stuff, but I'm learning quick. I've been on it about 2 years now, getting better. But, you know, it's unbelievable. I've been up in Minnesota here for, 18 years, I guess. I came down here in 91 when we had that 36-inch blizzard. And I said, man, what did I get myself into? And anyway, this last winter was one of the mildest winters I ever seen up here in all that time. This year started off like a bang. We've had nothing but snow and cold weather since the beginning of, or in the middle of October. And this is only the beginning. I mean, we got January, February to go through yet. And if this isn't a sample of what's coming, it's going to be nastier up here as it is in UK. I'll tell you that right now. This is bad stuff. And you know it's coming from the Gulf. Mark, we'll have snow to July up here.
Yeah, it's kind of like the UP of Michigan, huh? You got two seasons. You got winter and the 4th of July. And that's about it. anyway... Yep, and I agree with Eve. If you have got a question or a comment and you haven't got a mic, put it in the text, and if we see it, we'll be more than happy to jump on it. I'd like to hear from as many people as possible, because that's what Midrash is about. Midrash is not about some guy pontificating. It's about a bunch of people getting together and studying the Bible together. That's what we want to do. Okay, so all I'm doing is trying to give you something to jump off on. That's what my notes are about, giving you something to jump off on so that we can discuss. Okay, have we got other questions or comments on up to the psalm, the middle of the psalm? If you have a mic, I'll be happy to give you the mic. If you want to put something in the text, that's right. That's very good, Kifa. You know that you're talking to a smart aleck, you know, and I'll take all those jokes that you want to throw at me. All right. Well, I'm going to assume that we have no more questions or comments, and I'm going to move on with the rest of the psalm. I only read through 18, so we'll start with 19. In fact, I'm going to start with 18. Yehovah knoweth the days of the upright, and their inheritance shall be forever. They shall not be ashamed in the evil time, and in the days of famine they shall be satisfied. Do you get that? If you're faithful, if you're listening to what he has to say, and you're doing what he tells you to do, he promises that in the evil time you will not hunger. You will not have want. You may get only what you need, but you will not want for anything. Okay? Here we go. Verse 20. But the wicked shall perish, and the enemies of Yehovah shall be as the fat of lambs. They shall consume, into smoke shall they consume away. The wicked borroweth and payeth not again, but the righteous showeth mercy and giveth. For such as be blessed of him shall inherit the earth, and they that be cursed of him shall be cut off. The steps of a good man are ordered by Jehovah, and he delighteth in his way. Though he fall, he shall not be utterly cast down, and Jehovah upholdeth him with his hand. I have been young, and now am old. Yet have I not seen the righteous forsaken, nor his seed begging bread. He is ever merciful, and lendeth, and his seed is blessed. Depart from evil, and be good, and dwell forevermore. For Jehovah loveth judgment, and forsaketh not his saints. They are preserved forever. But the seed of the wicked shall be cut off. The righteous shall inherit the land, and dwell therein forever. The mouth of the righteous speaketh wisdom, and his tongue talketh of judgment. The law of Elohim is in his heart. None of his steps shall slide. The wicked watcheth the righteous, and seeketh to slay him. Jehovah will not leave him in his hand, nor condemn him when he is judged. Wait on Jehovah, and keep his way, and he shall exalt thee to inherit the land, where the wicked are cut off. When the wicked are cut off, thou shalt see it. I have seen the wicked in great power, and spreading himself like a green bay tree. Yet he passeth away, and lo, he was not. Yea, I sought him, but he could not be found. Mark the perfect man. That's my life verse right there. Mark the perfect man. Let me get back to it. Mark the perfect man and uphold the upright, for the end of that man is peace. But the transgressor shall be destroyed together. The end of the wicked shall be cut off. But the salvation of the righteous is of Jehovah. He is their strength in the time of trouble. And Jehovah shall help them and deliver them. He shall deliver them from the wicked and save them because they trust in him. All that will be left of the wicked, according to verse 20, is the particulate matter in the smoke. In the time of trouble, the righteous will mercifully give and not lack, and both the giver and the recipient shall inherit the land, while the cursed will be cut off from the land. The fact that this fire produces smoke tells me that it's after Armageddon and not post-millennial. That fire will be momentary and all-consuming, that which is post-millennial. There won't be any smoke there. My ex libris is in verse 21. The wicked borroweth and payeth not again. If you borrow a book from me, it has that posted in it in at least four or five different places. Sometimes right out in the middle of the book, you know, when you get to the end of a chapter, there it'll be. To remind you that the wicked borrows but doesn't give back what he borrowed. Okay? It kind of shames people into returning the borrowed book. But the righteous is a merciful giver. You get that? The righteous man gives mercifully. He sees somebody in need and he gives of what he has. When what we do is in Jehovah's order, our way is delightful. Even when we fall, we don't stay down because Jehovah picks us up. In all of David's life, which was considerably long, he'd never seen a righteous man begging for food. The righteous man is also prudent. He makes provision for lean times, like Yosef did in Egypt. Yaakov never begged for food, though he did have to go buy some. Buying is not the same as begging. Yaakov had provided for the eventuality of a general famine by laying aside some silver and gold to purchase what he could not grow for himself. That is biblical wisdom and prudence. Proverbs 22:3 and 27:12 both say exactly the same words, and they are this: a prudent man foreseeth evil and hideth himself, but the simple pass on and are punished. In other words, a prudent man sees what's coming and he prepares for it. That's what Eddie's 5-minute update is about, is to let you know what's coming and how it's unfolding. And that's what I try to pursue in the midrashes as well, is to let you know that the time is coming and we need to prepare for it. Okay? The righteous is ever merciful and he gives to the needs of others. When we depart from evil, we're showing our good judgment. When we do good, when we obey Him, we prove that we are His, and He protects us. The righteous speak wisdom because the Torah of Elohim is in their hearts. David speaks of the new covenant 400 years before its introduction in Yirmiyahu 31. How can that be? Do you suppose it was known beforehand? In Job chapter 22 and 22 it says, "Receive, I pray thee, the law from his mouth, and lay up his words in thine heart." Job, it's the oldest book in the Bible. Didn't he predate Moshe's books? You should all be nodding your heads at this point. He says, "The law from his mouth, lay up his words in your heart." He's talking about the new covenant. Job is. We need to see verses 32 and 33. The wicked watch for us to accuse us of crimes that are no crimes. This describes the law enforcement growth industry that exists today all over the world. Everyone listening to me prattle on right now probably are guilty of a crime that you've committed just while you've been sitting here listening to me prattle on. You didn't mean to do it, but there are so many laws on the books that you can't possibly help but be a criminal. The ridiculousness of our all-pervasive and unlawful legal system has gotten that crazy. Yehovah wants us to know that He doesn't hold the righteous guilty of anything that they have trumped up against Him. And He will not leave him, that is you, to suffer because of that stupidity. Remember the admonitions of the last few weeks to keep your trap shut when they're doing their investigations. Shema to it. Don't just hear it. Listen to it and put it into practice. Answer only what they ask and volunteer nothing to them, because they are going to find a way to bring charges against you by the words of your very own mouth. You have the right to remain silent. Use it. Wait on Yehovah and guard His way. He will not leave you. The wicked may seize power for a while, but Yehovah will see to them in His time, and it will not be long before He delivers us. My life's verse is 37:37a, as I told you before, mark the perfect man. Now, I'm kidding about that, of course. But what it means is that you need to watch the complete man who is upright, because his end will be peace, will be shalom. If you are upright, living Torah out of love for the Father who gave His Son to buy you out of bondage, you will know shalom. Shalom is not the cessation of conflict with other men or nations. In the Bible, when it talks about shalom, it's cessation of conflict with Yehovah, agreeing with Him. When we have shalom with Yehovah, we will be the targets of the wicked's arrows, the wicked people's arrows. They will hate us because we have such peace. Jealousy is their motivation, and pride is what keeps them from the same shalom. But when all men have shalom with Yehovah, the natural result will be the cessation of conflict with men. When they are doing everything in their power to shatter our shalom, and the more we live in it, the crazier they will get. But Yehovah will deliver us from the wicked when He destroys them by the word of His mouth. And He will do that first in Armageddon, and second after the Gog-Magog rebellion at the end of the millennial period, when they come up against those who follow Yehovah into the last Sukkot of the millennium. And they're camped around Jerusalem for Sukkot. And the whole world comes against them. And Yehovah is going to say, "I'm tired of this," and with the word of His mouth comes fire from heaven and consumes them. That's the last time that smoke will ever happen as a result of Yehovah's judgment on people. Okay. He is our strength and our Yeshua when we trust Him. What have we to fear? We have nothing to fear, nothing whatsoever to fear. Okay, we're open again for questions and comments on the Torah, Haftarah, or the Psalm. Anyone have a question or a comment? Please raise your hand or put a question or comment in the text. And if you've put one in, you know, last 4 or 5 minutes, do it again so I can see it. Yes. Yes, yes, yes. Okay, Patty by Grace, see you later. I guess you're already gone by now, bro. Put on the whole armor so that the arrows of the wicked bounce off. That's good, Grafted. Very good. When you start talking spiritual, isn't that replacement theology? Why would it be? Why would that be replacement theology? Because you start to see things in a deeper mode than just what's written on the page. Yeah. The remez is a hint. The derash is an actual application, and the sod is the deep, deep things of Elohim. So, you know, those are all spiritual insights that you get from reading the Peshat. Of course, that's spiritual, but that isn't replacement theology. Yes, sometimes you will see, when you're reading through the scripture, you'll see how it ties to another scripture, and not necessarily what the scripture says on the page, but what the application of it is to your own life. Okay, so I mean that's the hints. Oh, the church claims that they're spiritual Israel. That's where you get that from. Yeah, that's replacement theology, but that isn't seeing the spiritual meaning in the text. A bit of the replacement stuff. Well, we just saw it. Crystal just gave that to us. The church sees itself as spiritual Israel, and in a way, they can be. Not necessarily that they are, but that they can be. You know, you are not going to inherit anything from Yehovah unless you are Israel. Now, I am grafted into the Israelite tree, okay, grafted in. I don't replace anybody. I'm added to. Okay, and I partake of the same root that they partake of. So I'm not replacing anybody. I'm just added in there, and I try to have fellowship, you know, and learn things from them. And sometimes they'll let me, and sometimes they won't. Yeah, just because we're seeing a spiritual application of something doesn't necessarily mean we're trying to replace Israel, or replace, the Jews, as it were. That's not the case. By the way, when it says in the Gospels that the Jews did this against, Messiah, or they did that against Messiah, or they, you know, it's not talking about, Israel in general. It's talking about the leadership of the Hebrew religion. When it talks about the Jews it's talking about those people who are in the political leadership of the religion of Israel. Okay? And so those people who were doing that for their political purposes, trying to hold on to their political power and their religious power, they were exercising they were going against the 10th commandment. They were coveting something that wasn't theirs to covet. Okay? They had it in their possession, the power, and they didn't want to lose it. That's coveting as well as wanting something that somebody else has. That's what Paul was dealing with all of his life. He tells us in Romans chapter 7. You know, I wouldn't know what sin was if the scripture hadn't told me, thou shalt not covet. That was his problem, covetousness. That's why that's what stood up to him. Also, by the way, the rich young ruler that came to Jehovah, or Yeshua, and he said, what must I do to be saved? And Yeshua said, you know the commandments. Don't kill. Don't commit adultery. Don't steal. Don't bear false witness. And he stops. And the rich young ruler says, I've kept all of those since my youth. This is great. And then Yeshua says, well, you have one thing that you still lack. Take all that you've had, that you have, sell it, give it to the poor, and come follow me, and you'll have everything in the life to come. And the guy walks away because he's bummed because he has so much that he has to give up. Okay? I think that was Shaul, the student of Gamaliel. Okay? That's what I think. I could be wrong, but I think that. Okay? I think that there's good possibility of that. Because that was Shaul's problem. And he didn't know what sin was until he understood, thou shalt not covet. And it was from that encounter with Yeshua that made him understand it. That's what I think. So, anyway, other questions are coming. Vic Taylor, you have a hand up. You may have the mic. Oh, the thorn in Paul's flesh was, I believe, was his bad eyesight, but I'm not sure.
Okay, thanks, Mark. I just want to comment on your comments with respect to the rich guy coming to Yeshua and ask him what he must do to inherit eternal life. And the Messiah utters the six commandments with respect to how you get along with your neighbor. And, of course, he said, I dealt out these. But he didn't do the first four. His God was money. And Messiah didn't tell him to sell all he got and give it to the poor. He said, sell what you have. He wanted to demonstrate to the rich man that, hey, money is your God because that's who you worship. And that's the test that the Messiah gave him. He said, sell all you have and give to the poor. He didn't say give it all to the poor. You won't find that. But he just wanted to demonstrate that he wasn't worshiping God. He was worshiping money, because you can worship money as your God and still carry out the commandments that are related to love your neighbor. You know, don't steal, don't kill, don't commit adultery, you know, and so forth. Don't lie and don't covet. But anyway, I just want to point that out, because, you know, I don't think... anyway, I just want to point out, he didn't say give it all to the poor. He just said, give to the poor. That's in the scriptures that I have, King James. Anyway, yield the mic.
Yes, and I take that correction in the spirit in which it was given. You're absolutely correct. I spoke wrong. Yes, he said, give to the poor. And, again, that's the reason that I think that may have been Paul. Okay? Because of what Paul tells us later on. You know, about how he was, I mean, he tells you about, I'm a Pharisee of the Pharisees, you know, I had this and I have that, and I have this and I have that, you know, and all of those things he coveted. And covetousness, I think one of the other reasons that he didn't mention covetousness is because it is the basis for every other sin that we commit. Okay? If we didn't covet something that really wasn't ours to have, then we would not be in the sin sick condition that we are. Okay? And that's a very hard thing to first of all not want something that somebody else has, okay, because you get jealous of it, and also to it's also hard to give up what you already have. To give up what you already have is really hard. Okay? And, so that's where I'm coming from on that, anyway. Are there other questions or comments up through the psalm for today? I'm sorry. There was something about the Barnabas, the Gospel of Barnabas. I don't put a lot of stock in it. I haven't actually read it recently. I read it long, long ago. I don't put a lot of stock in. I think that some of those extra biblical writings can be good teaching us about the culture of the time and stuff like that, and they're valuable in that way. But I do not believe that they are anything like the Word of Yehovah, and so I don't put a lot of stock in them, except as historically accurate stuff. Most of them are, like the Maccabees. You know, I read the 1 and 2 Maccabees, and they tell us about the history of Israel from the time that Antiochus set the abomination of desolation in the holy place, had it on the altar, and when they cleansed the altar, and that was about a 3-year period of time. You know, that is a very good history, and we ought to read that, especially around Hanukkah time, so we understand what it's all about. But, you know, to celebrate Hanukkah because of it? Not necessarily. Okay? But to understand what that time is about, we ought to do that. Barnaba. What is that? I've never even heard of Barnaba. That's something new to me. I assume that's Barnabas. Anyway, Vic Taylor has his hand up. I'm going to give him the mic. Take it away, Vic, and I'm going to be away from the keyboard for about 2 minutes.
Okay, Mark, thank you. I just want to mention, the Maccabees is in the Jerusalem Bible, excuse me, which I have a copy of, and the Feast of Hanukkah is outlined in that, but of course the Jewish people claim the festival that is celebrated by the Jewish people is not what is related in Maccabees, you know, where the miracle of the oil is, it was supposedly have only 1 day supply of oil, and it lasted 8 or 9 days. That's just not in the book of Maccabees. So that must come from tradition or some invention they created. Anyway, that's all I want to say about Hanukkah. But I want to tell you that they have Jewish people going around in the Gentile schools and teaching that story about the miracle of the oil and Hanukkah. Anyway, I yield the mic. Yeah, the oil is a bunch of hype is right. Exactly. That's what I say.
Okay. Yeah. The oil was just a bunch of that's all Talmudic. There was nothing about that even in the Talmud until like 300 or 400 CE, the Common Era. Okay, so yeah, that's a bunch of garbage. I don't know who gave Constantine to King James, and said King James didn't actually edit. I don't think he didn't have anything to do with it. He had like 38 or 40 or something like that textual scholars, as it were, to create a good translation for the people. Okay, I don't know that they actually edited anything. I got to take that back. There are some places where they actually did put their own theological bias in, and that would be editing. So, but other than that, they did do a pretty well creditable job of translating the scripture into vernacular English. That was what it was for. Like I said, there are some traditional biases in there that you need to get around, but they're pretty minor. And yes, grafted, you're absolutely correct. About 80% of that was Tyndale's translation. And they put some, and Tyndale's translation was from 150 or 200 years earlier. And so they were putting it into a vernacular of the day, which was that the Middle English, which is actually a much better English than what we speak today. Especially when it comes to second person pronouns. You know, you, your, the, thy, that kind of stuff. If you see a TH, that generally is talking about a singular, second person singular. And when you see a Y at the beginning of the word, that's generally speaking of a second person plural. Okay, so it's actually easier for me to understand that King James than it is to understand like an NIV or something like that, where they just use you and your and like that, because how do you know which one is which? But when you go into the Tanakh, you'll read Elohecha, okay, thy Elohim, singular, or Elohechem, your Elohim, plural. See, and they'll translate it properly. They did that at least in the second person, and I think it's easier to. What is Hanukkah about? It's about the cleansing of the temple. It has nothing to do with the that oil thing. What they did was they had it that year during Sukkot, and they tell you this in the Maccabees. That year during Sukkot, they were running from the Greeks, and they were up in the hills, running away from the Greeks. And by the time that the 25th of Kislev came along, they had defeated the Greeks and chased them out, and they had also already torn down the altar, torn up the stones beneath the altar, dug out all the dirt for 15-20 feet of dirt from the top of the mountain, replaced the stones with new stones and a new altar, and they dedicated that altar. And they took they had an 8-day feast to replace the Sukkot that they were running from the Greeks about. That was what that was about. Hanukkah was originally the Feast of Tabernacles for that year. They weren't able to keep it, and so they kept it with the cleansing of the temple. And they made up this story about the oil. There's nothing in the historical accounts about the menorah burning for 8 days on one day's supply of oil. Nothing. 7 days plus the last great day. That's exactly right, Mesheka. Okay. Other questions or comments? Vic Taylor, you may have the mic.
Thank you, Mark. Since you know a lot about, I forget most of the Hanukkah story. I didn't realize it was at the time of the Feast of Sukkot. But anyway, I want to just bring up someone who was mentioning the Bible of Tyndale's, and you said it was a couple, almost 150 years old, earlier than King James, and I agree with that. And I want to point out that the famous verses, which supposedly, first of all, I want to say that John's Gospel, according to many theologians and scholars in the Catholic Bible, in the foreword to John's Gospel, they declare that it has been edited, altered, and added to by the scribes. And it was to support the extant doctrine of the deity of the Messiah and the Trinity. So, and I want to just point out that Tyndale, when you look at the John chapter 1, verses 1, you know, in the beginning was God, and God was with, the Word was with God, and the Word was God, and it goes on to use a personal pronoun to explain or to identify the word logos, and it's referred as a he in the King James, but in the Tyndale edition, the word is an it, I-T. It's not a personal, it's not personified. But in the King James Version of that Bible, they personify the Logos as he, as if a living person. But it, you know, when you really understand it, it, the word is not a living, thinking, doing person. Anyway, yield the mic.
Thank you, Vic. We're going to have a look at that. Yeah, that was that is interesting. Let me go there real quick. Like, I'd like to see that. In the KJV, it says, John chapter 1, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with Elohim, and the Word was Elohim. The same was in the beginning with Elohim. All things were made by Him, and without Him was not anything made that was made. And you say that the Tyndale says, and by it, and without it was not anything made that was made. Is that correct? Aha. Interesting. Now I got to find the Tyndales, because I don't have one. Although, you know, they call Tyndale publishers after him because that's what he did, was translated the Bible into the vernacular of his day. Yeah, interesting. Okay, I'll have to look into that. Thank you very much. Are there other questions or comments? That was the point, Servant 60. The Memra is what the word is in the Aramaic, and it's talking about the Memra is the personification, well, not the personification, the manifestation of the word of Elohim. It isn't necessarily a person. Now, Yeshua is seen to be the personification of the Memra, or the Memra taking human flesh. That is a possibility. But again, it's not Yeshua, the physical being, the physical body, that is the Memra. It is the spirit that dwelt within him that would be the Memra. Okay? So, when somebody says, is Yeshua Yahweh, I have to say, he is Yehovah's word in the flesh. I'll go with that. He's the Memra in the flesh. But is Yeshua the flesh Yahweh? No. No, the flesh is not Yahweh. Okay? The flesh had to die. Yahweh can't die. He's spirit. There's no way he can die. But he had to experience all of that, just like we had to experience all of that in order for him to be our perfect high priest. Essences of his spirit, you might say that. You might say that. Okay. Are there other questions or comments? You're welcome, Servant 60. I hope that clarified things for you and didn't make it even crazier for you. Meg. Hi, Mom. That's wonderful. Torah dude got red-dotted. Good. You can unred-dot him now. Welcome, Torah dude. Glad to see you here. Boy steps in here and he gets red-dotted immediately. I'm going to tell you all why that is right now. 2008, we went out to Monty's for Sukkot, and Torah dude came and introduced himself to me. And he is a great guy. He really is. He's a wonderful, wonderful brother. And I love seeing the guy. I love meeting him, and we talked, and we had a good time together. And I told him, from now on, you are Mr. Red Dot. Whenever you come into my room or Beit Yaakov's room, you are going to get red dotted on the spot, and then you're going to get unred dotted. I just want to let you know. You know, so when you see Torah dude, that's a standing order. He gets red dotted, and then the red dot comes off because I want to let him. As soon as we see him, because I don't want him to wait, you know, and worry about getting red dotted later. So anyway, we're in the middle of it here, Torah dude, and we would, if you have a mic and you'd like to come on and make a question or a comment, you're more than welcome to. We have just finished the psalm, and we're getting ready to go to the Brit Hadashah, which is going to be Luke chapter 19, and I think the last 8 or 10 verses. Let's go to Luke. Find 19. It's here somewhere. There he is. and 37 at the end of the chapter? Yes. Questions or comments from anybody? Okay. Well then, we're going to go ahead and get started. Luke chapter 19. Verses 37 through 48, starting in verse 37. And when he was come nigh, even now at the descent of the Mount of Olives, the whole multitude of the disciples began to rejoice and praise Elohim with a loud voice for all the mighty works that they had seen, saying, Blessed be the King that cometh in the name of Jehovah. Peace in heaven and glory in the highest. And some of the Pharisees from among the multitude. By the way, let me show you this in verse 37. And when he was come nigh, even now at the descent of the Mount of Olives, the whole multitude of the disciples began to rejoice. And then in verse 39. And some of the Pharisees from among the multitude. So these are Pharisees who believe that he is Mashiach. They believe that he is Mashiach ben David because they're calling for the king. Okay? Coming in the name of Jehovah. Okay. And they say, Master, rebuke your disciples. And he answered and said unto them, I tell you that if these should hold their peace, the very stones would immediately cry out. And when he was come near, he beheld the city and wept over it, saying, If thou hadst known, even thou, at least in this thy day, the things which belong unto thy peace, for now they are hid from thine eyes. For the day shall come upon thee, that thine enemies shall cast a trench about thee, and compass thee around, and keep thee in on every side, and shall lay thee even to the ground, and thy children within thee. And they shall not leave in thee one stone upon another, because thou knewest not the time of thy visitation. And he went into the temple, and began to cast out them that sold therein, and them that bought, saying unto them, It is written, My house is the house of prayer, but ye have made it into a den of robbers. It says thieves in King James, but it's robbers. And he taught daily in the temple, but the chief priests and the scribes and the chief of the people sought to destroy him. Get that? He taught daily in the temple, but the chief priests and the scribes and the chief of the people sought to destroy him. So we have the religion, the culture, the politics are working together to destroy him. And those are the Jews in the, especially in John's Gospel. John uses the word Jews a lot to talk about these people. But in verse 48 it says, And could not find what they might do, for all the people were very attentive to hear him. The people did not reject Yeshua. The bankers, very good, Vic. The bankers, the economy, the politics, and the religion were against him because they had this position among the Romans and they didn't want to lose it. See, they were coveting their position. So, let me get on with my, I'll get into that a little, maybe a little bit better here. I don't remember exactly. Anyway, it was the 10th day of the first biblical month in the last year of Yeshua's ministry. He had his disciples go into town and borrow the foal of an ass. Some of his disciples laid their talitot on the foal's back, while others were laying them in the street for the foal to walk on as he entered Jerusalem. When he got to the east gate that faces the Mount of Olives, all of his disciples began giving thanks and praising Yehovah, shouting, Baruch HaMelech Haba B'Shem Yehovah, Shalom b'shamayim v'kavod be'elyon. Bless the King who comes in the name of Yehovah. Shalom in heaven and glory in the highest. Yeshua was presenting himself as King to the religious authorities. But if they accepted him as such, the political positions they'd built themselves under Roman rule, including the high priesthood by political appointment, would cease to exist. Please note that the Pharisees had asked him to control his rabble were from among them, from among his rabble. The Pharisees came from the same multitude. These were Pharisees who believed Yeshua was Messiah, who were asking him to curb the others' enthusiasm, probably for fear of losing their positions. I think that these may have been the party who questioned Shaul about the need to circumcise converts into Judaism before allowing them to be mikvahed into the way. And that would cause the controversy in Acts chapter 15. When Yeshua answered them, "If I shut them up, the very stones would take up in chorus," I think they began to think twice about their allegiance with him. This was the time of Yeshua's visitation, of Israel's visitation. Isaiah refers to this day in chapter 10 and verse 3, where it says, "And what will ye do in the day of visitation, and in the desolation which shall come from far? To whom will ye flee for help, and where will ye leave your glory?" Yeshua wept over the decision of the Jews, the leaders of the Hebrew religion, were going to make about him. What follows is speculation. What I'm about to say is speculation. I think that had they made shalom with Yeshua, the glory would have come to Israel right then. He still would have had to die as the Paschal Lamb, but they would have had no part of it. Okay? The Jews would have had no part of it. They would have suffered for 3 days at the hands of Pilate until he rose from the dead, the death that Pilate would have subjected him to. But when he rose, they'd have set up his kingdom, or he'd have set up his kingdom on a spot. He would have been picked at the world system, and everything from that point would have been entirely different than what it has been and what it is. For one thing, I would not be pontificating on Pal Talk, at least not in the same capacity I do now. He wept for the city and for them, not for what would happen to him as a result of their rejection. No matter what, he had to die the death of the adulterous woman in Numbers 5. But Plan B2 would not have been necessary. B2. Once again, man was given a choice. Remember Indiana Jones, Raiders of the Lost Ark, the Holy Grail? Remember that? They would have had a choice, number one, of the Tree of Life, acceptance of the King, or number two, the Tree of Knowledge, rejection of the King. And once again, we, as the Templar said, in that movie, he said, they chose poorly. Had they chosen him and Plan B1, the city would have been destroyed by Rome 40 years, would not have been destroyed by Rome 40 years hence. The people would not have been dispersed as Israel has been, and Israel would have been gathered then. Everything would necessarily have been different than it has been. Then he went up to the temple complex after they went through all of this. He went up to the temple complex and he presented himself for inspection as the Pesach lamb. After he wept, he went up there. For the next 4 days, he would be there for inspection by the priests for blemishes. And while they would not pronounce him acceptable, Pilate would 4 times. Since the high priest would not perform his duty over the Pesach lamb, Pilate did, took over for him. Here is a principle that has worked for time immemorial. When believers refuse to do their duty, the civil government steps in and does it for them. We don't care for the sick and injured. The civil government imposes its version of care for the sick on all of us. Because we refuse to do our duty, we lose the liberty to do our duty. So we can stop blaming the politicians for our lost liberty. We didn't lose it. We threw it away. When he was cleansing the temple, he quoted from two prophets. In Isaiah chapter 56 and verse 7, it says, "Even them will I bring to my holy mountain, and make them joyful in my house of prayer. Their burnt offerings and their sacrifices shall be accepted upon mine altar, for mine house shall be called an house of prayer for all people." Isaiah chapter 56 and 7. Then in Jeremiah chapter 7 and verse 11, he says, "In this house, which is called by my name, Is this house, rather, which is called by my name, become a den of robbers in your eyes? Behold, even I have seen it, saith Yehovah. Well, Yehovah in the flesh of Yeshua certainly did see it, didn't he? And the zeal of Yehovah Tzevaoth addressed that blasphemy. He came back every day for the next 4 days, and no one was able to find fault with him according to Torah. Please notice that the people loved him and attended to his every word. It was the political leadership of the Hebrew religion, whom John calls the Jews 64 times in his gospel, that were threatened by him. The words "the" and "Jews" appear in the same verse 238 times in the entire Bible, King James Bible. So John's gospel uses more than a quarter of all of the uses in Scripture, and 80% of its uses in the Gospels. It only comes up 80 times in the Gospels altogether. I think that the Jews does not describe all adherence to Judaism. The Jews describes the power structure of Judaism. So when the church says all Israel rejected their Messiah, it is just wrong. The people of Israel loved Yeshua. The Jews feared him. Kind of sheds new light on Romans 9:6, doesn't it? They are not all Israel who are of Israel. Okay, open to questions and comments. Anyone got a question? Oh, Vic Taylor's got one. Take the mic, Vic.
Thank you, Mark. Yes, the Jews are mentioned many times in John's Gospel. Well, I just want to point out that maybe you know this already, or maybe I'm sure some in the room already know this. The term Jude, as you all know, the letter J didn't come into existence till around the 14th, 15th century. And the first time the word Jew was ever used was by this Robert Sheridan. He used it in a play. And when they translated, most of the Bibles you have in your hand today were all translated into the English that you have. They insert the word Jew. Now, the word Jew in the Bible, it could have been referred to the people from those people from the house of Judah, or the people living in the geographical location called Judea. So the word Jew could have been referred to a Chinese person living in Judea. He would have been called a Judean, or of someone from a true house of Judah would have been also called, a Judahite. But they used that word Jew, incessantly, continuously throughout those Gospels. And the last remark I want to make is that the rabbis, when they're talking about the house of Israel, they'll, even in the Torah, when it's a reference to the house of Israel, they'll say the Jewish people, when they're giving their homilies during Sabbath, they'll say the Jewish people left Israel or left Egypt, the Jewish people did, and it's misleading, because there's no such people called Jews in the Bible. They're either called Judahites or Judeans. And the Messiah lived in Galilee, and he wasn't a Jew. He was a Galilean. Anyway, I yield the mic.
Yeah, everything you said is true. Everything you said is true. I refer to the Chumash because those guys have some insight that's valuable. Okay, so I read it. Most of the stuff that they have is trash, but some of it's very good. And so I read it because I don't throw away the baby with the bathwater. I just throw away the bathwater. So they can teach me something. I know they can. But you're right. As you're reading through there, I mean, they call Abraham a Jew. They call Jacob a Jew. And they're not. Jew means that you're either of the tribe of the religion of Judaism, or you are of the tribe of Judah, or of the tribal inheritance of Judah. And Vic brought that all up. And he's right. The term isn't even used in the King James until shortly before the captivity into Babylon. Israel is already gone. And by the way, Israel has never returned. Never. When the rabbis will tell you that Israel came back with the Jews after the Babylonian captivity with Ezra and Nehemiah. But if you read through there, you'll find you know, the genealogies, you'll find out that there's nobody there from any other tribe except for Judah and Benjamin. and Levi. The Levites came back with them too. Some Levites. And that was a very small minority. It was a remnant of people. Grand total of 40,000 went back to the land. 43,000, I think, total. When hundreds of thousands or millions were carried off. So most of them stayed in Babylon. And only a few who wanted to follow the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob went back. So when Yeshua comes and he regathers all of the 12 tribes, you know, the remnant of all of the 12 tribes, we're going to see Jews and Ephraimites and Naphtalites and Asherites and Danites and everybody coming from the four corners of the earth, from all directions to the promised land. And that will happen after he puts his foot on the Mount of Olives. Or possibly at exactly the same time. But not before. Okay. Yeah, Joseph was not a Jew. Joseph was a Josephite. As a matter of fact, we're going to see next week where Judah, the first person who could properly be called a Jew, okay, where Judah comes to Joseph and says, "I'll be your servant. Send Benjamin home. If he doesn't go home, his father is going to die of grief. Keep me instead of him." And that's where Judah becomes a man. A man after Yahweh's heart. Okay? And by the way, a man after my heart too. I love men who are willing to do that. You know, I look at the great heroes of Western fame, you know, like, John Wayne movies, you know, the characters that guy played. Those were heroes. He was terrible playing them, but they were heroes. You know? Those are men. And that's the kind of guy that I think Yehuda became. Someone who was willing to do whatever it took to do what was right. You know, to do what Yehovah wanted to do. So, anyway. And I hope that I can be that kind of man when the time comes. Anyway, questions or comments? Any questions or comments? What are you talking about, Albara? 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 I'm sorry, whatever. Can I know what you're talking about? What are we asking about? Mark, you shared up there. Let me find something from Rover up here. Shabbat Shalom keeps. Your input, please, Mark, on what? Ah, I'm sorry. Here we go. About a month ago, I was in a chat room in which I asked the question, how many of you can say you have a safe house to help those who need help? There were 67 persons in the chat. None said they were a safe house. But many started giving excuses as to why they do not serve Yehovah like this. The least we do unto each other, we do unto Yahushua. Yes, that is true. And can I say that my house is a safe house? I believe it is at this point, and I have enough space for people to come and camp there. But my house? Too small. Couldn't possibly. But is that what you're talking about, Rover? There are places, I'm sure, that Yehovah has set aside, and he's put it on their owners' hearts to open to people who need it. I know of at least two places that Yes, and I agree with that. And you know what? People will, you know, I assume that when that time comes, Yehovah will lead them to that place. Okay? People who are trusting him will get the idea of where they should go, who they should call. Like I said, my property where I live right now is open to people who want to come out and camp, but there's no place for me to put them up, really. Yeah, I agree with that, Rob. Where are you from, Aldara? E-Sword, yeah, you can do that online. In the UK. There must be places where you can get a Bible in the UK. I can't imagine that there would not be some place where you could get your hands on one. There would probably be churches that would be willing to give you one. Why are we talking about safe houses, Torah dude? Because the time is coming, and it won't be long before we're gonna need to worry about that. I really think that the time is coming, possibly as early as this year, this coming year, that we're gonna need to have some place to go. We'll be turned out of where we are. The government is just getting that bad. I can just see them taking over people's property, and nothing you can do about it. You know, they'll come in and take it at gunpoint if they have to. And you know what? That it's the urbanite that is in the biggest trouble, Vic. Say most of us are urbanites. I don't know about that. It may be true, but yeah. It's the people who live in cities that are going to have the worst trouble. They're going to be the first ones to get separated from their property, because there are more people there to separate it from them. Anyway, Vic has his hand up, and I'm going to give it to him. And I'm really going to be leaving the mic for about a minute and a half or 2 minutes. So keep up for a couple of seconds there, Vic, and I'll be back.
Okay, Mark. Thanks very much. I don't know if the room has heard that a law has been passed now. I don't know if it's passed, but it's in the House, ready to be passed by the Senate, at least in those people who are Americans in this room, that you can't grow food. It's going to be illegal to grow food, to store it, or to distribute it. It will be distributed or sell it. It'll be against the law. So, I don't know. If you're growing food and storing it or selling it, you will be charged. You'll be, anything and everything you own can be confiscated. And that's the law that is now on the table. I don't know if it's, I think it's S510. I think the law, that's the number of law. I'm not sure, but S510. You can't grow the food yourself. You can't hoard it or store it. And you can't distribute it or sell it. It's almost treated like a drug, as marijuana is today. And it's called, it's under the Safety Food Act. You know, it's an Orwellian doublespeak. You know, evil is good. You know, safety, it's for our safety when it's not for our safety. Anything that the American or the U.S. administration, these laws that are passed, they're all presented as being good and safe and for our benefit when it's not. Anyway, I yield the mic. Mark may be back now. Okay, thank you, Mark.
Yep, it's all for your own good. Don't you know that? Yep. It's all FYG. For your for, oh, wait a minute, FYOG, for your own good. There you go. It's all for your own good, don't you know that? You're too stupid to take care of yourself. The government has to do it for you. Well, you know what? When it comes to growing things, I am pretty stupid. I'm not a very good farmer. But that doesn't mean that I can't. I most certainly can. Just have to get off my butt and do something about it. Yes, you moved away from the city. Good, Solace Radio, Torah 101. And that's wonderful. You are fortunate. I moved away from the city 15 years ago because I fully expected to see really bad stuff happening back then. And it's gotten nothing but worse. The tyranny has gotten nothing but worse. So, I could see it in the next couple of months. I mean, I can just see it happening. And it pains me to see the America that our founders gave us turn into what it has become. Yeah. So. Yes, Monsanto definitely wanted that thing done. And ADM and people like that. And you're right, it's not strong enough for them. It's an absolutely wicked piece of legislation, and I hope that the new Congress repeals it. Yep. Okay, so are there any other questions or comments on the Midrashic Bible study for today? And if not, we've got, 20 minutes or so that we can just field questions if you'd like. That's exactly right. And by the way, it has to be in basic control of the entire government, or the entire world, rather, for 3 years. Let's read the bill before everyone wraps around the axle. That's pretty good, granted. You're absolutely right, but I have seen some of the provisions of it, and some of that bill says that they'll be able to come in and tell you what you can grow, how much you can grow, how much you can keep of what you've grown, and that's just tyranny. Oh no, you can get your hands on the entire bill. You can Google S510. And that thing will come up for you. I mean, it'll give you a number of different things. You get it from the congressional record. It's there, and it's accessible. You can do it. That's a capital S, but yeah, S510, Senate Bill 510. Okay, thank you, Vic. Yeah, we don't want many cans in here. My goodness gracious, there are 55 of you in here. Amazing. Can't imagine that many people that want to listen to me pontificate. There's something wrong with you people, I got to tell you. Okay, so there were 60. I can't believe that. Anyway, that you're lying to me to make me feel good, Roni Mama. So are there other questions or comments? I know, I'm kidding with you. Other questions or comments? I'm more than happy to give up the mic if you have something you want to say. Would you like the link to S510 grafted? You have my permission to put it in. Vic, you want the mic? You may have it. Take it away, bro.
Thanks, Mark. Why there's 55 in here, here's what I believe. You've got a good teacher yourself, and we're given the opportunity to text, and we're given the opportunity to ask questions. So you've got a great room in that respect. You've got a good teacher. We're allowed to text. We're allowed to ask questions on the mic. So I believe that is the reason why he has so many people in here, and that God is blessing you with people who are willing to listen. And I yield the mic.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate that. Exactly right. We're not afraid of questions. Not at all. We're not afraid of you presenting a different perspective than what we have, because I believe that the scripture needs to be seen from different perspectives. Okay? Different people's experiences will have them see things a little bit differently. And the Spirit may use that to enlighten me. That's why I want to have as much discussion as I can get. Because I want, you know, I want to learn. You guys can all teach me, and believe me, I'm not here to be a teacher. I'm here to be a facilitator more than anything. I want to have a midrashic Bible study where people will get together and talk. That's what I want to see here. So, and it's getting that way. We've had four or five different people on the mic today. This has been great. I'd like to have, you know, we got 58 people in the room. I got 58 people in the room right now. I'd love to hear from half of you, you know, every time. I'd love it. Superimposed on the Gregorian calendar is Saturday. Well, because the Gregorian calendar has a pagan name for each day of the week. Okay? It's Sabbath isn't superimposed on it. The Gregorian calendar has its own names. You know, if you want to have the biblical names, you call it first day, second day, third day, fourth day, fifth day, sixth day, seventh. It's that simple. Now, unfortunately, the entire world uses the Gregorian calendar, or at least the entire Western world does. And so if you're going to do business with people, you have to know what those are, too. So, actually, probably the best thing you could do is to have a Michael Rood calendar that would give you the biblical day of the week. It actually has that on there, first day, second day, third day, fourth day, you know, and Sabbath. And also has something with the Gregorian, so that you can use one calendar instead of 15. Well, actually, I'm sorry, grafted in, you have this thing here, you say, now a private person can't take their stuff to a restaurant and serve it without certain controls. Nothing wrong with that. Yes, there is. The government doesn't have that power. It does not have that power. Look in the Constitution and see anywhere where it says that they're allowed to tell us what we can buy or sell. Okay? It's not there. That's one of the reasons that the health care bill got shot down, because the government said you must buy health insurance, and you must buy insurance that coincides with what we want you to have. Okay? And that's getting shot down. Oh, the Constitution is pretty much gone, but still, every once in a while, we'll get a proper ruling from the Supreme Court. If you ask the proper... I'll tell you what, when you go to the Supreme Court, it doesn't matter who the justices are. If you ask the right question, if you base your argument on the right question about the Constitution, they will give you the right answer, and they will find in your favor. Always. Never fails. The problem is that people go in there and they ask the wrong question, and the Supreme Court knows the principle. You answer the question that's given, not anything else. Okay, so they get this question, how does this apply to the Constitution, and they'll find some way for it to apply. Okay, but if you say, the Constitution says this, this says this, they contramand each other, Constitution takes precedence, the Supreme Court will hold in your favor. I mean, we've got maybe three justices that have an idea of what the Constitution says and keep to it all the time. And we've got five that are against it most of the time. But they still come up with the right answer as far as the health care bill. You can't tell people what they have to buy. It's not in there. Okay? Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution, it's only about a half a page, typewritten page, and that's all there is that gives Congress any power whatsoever. And the 10th Amendment says that any power not granted specifically to the Congress isn't theirs. They can't rule on it. And so, everything else is left to the states or to the people, respectively. I'm sorry, the states respectively or to the people. It actually refers to the people because the states are set up by them too. The ultimate power belongs in your hands and mine. Not in the state government, not in the county government, not in the federal government. Those only have the power that we give them. That's the way it's supposed to be. And that's the way it will be if you ask the right question in the Supreme Court. They will always give you the right answer. Anyway. Yeah, isn't that amazing? Your health insurance goes up 29% next month due to Obamacare. I haven't even gotten my bill yet for my health insurance for next week. You know, I'm paying $900 a month for my wife and me. And that includes all kinds of insurance. It's not just health insurance. It's health insurance, dental insurance, eye care, life insurance. I get life insurance through that too. Yeah. $900 a month for my wife and me. It's what I had with the company. And I've just kept that. I could probably find it cheaper. But I need a cheaper plan. Okay? But yeah, right now that's what it cost me, $895 a month. And I keep that because that's what I was under when I got hit with the tree. And everything that I'm going to the doctor for is related to that. And so to go to another health company or insurance company I'd have a pre-existing condition and they wouldn't cover it. Yeah, you get that now. That's why I'm paying that money. Okay. Well, anyway, we're getting close. Are there questions? Okay. Eddie just opened his, well, actually, Jocelyn just opened the room over there. So we're going to be closing down here in 10-15 minutes. Okay, so that you can go over and get the 5-minute update. Oh, Vic Taylor. Holy hell, Mark. Okay. Thanks, Vic. Appreciated your input today. 500-minute update? Could be. Anyway, I don't feel bad if you all want to go over there, because that's going to be some pretty good stuff. There's good stuff in that in his 5-minute update. I'll tell you what, and he's got a great teaching every week. So do not afford yourself of that. Obama hired 16,000 new IRS agents to collect all fines from not having health care. Yeah, he hired 16,000 new IRS agents. You know, those guys all carry a GS rating of at least 9. They're getting paid what a first class petty officer gets paid in the Navy. Okay? Which is in the neighborhood of $2,800 a month plus benefits. Incredible. Absolutely incredible. And that was the last I knew, $2,800 a month. It's probably more than that now for a first class petty officer. It's about finding new, well, I told you earlier that the government's purpose for existing is to separate you from your property and your liberty. And the more property they take, the more liberty they take. You know, well, the property is talking about your money and anything else you have that's of value. That's what their purpose is. The way that it's run now. It's not what its original purpose was. Its original purpose was to provide for the general welfare. That doesn't mean to provide welfare for people, but to provide so that you could get it, so that you could pursue your happiness. Well, not how it goes now. Not how it goes now. What the founders set up here was... I don't know if... I just got a... I'm sorry, secret place dweller. I'm not taking private messages right now because I'm in the middle of talking to y'all. But if you've got questions or comments and you'd like to put them in the text, I'd be more than happy to address it. I would say that our midrash is pretty much done. And Dumrod, if you're in here and you'd like to shut off the recorder, you're more than welcome to now. Okay. What happens if we don't have money to buy insurance? Well, then you have to wait on the Obamacare, I guess. Or actually, at this point, you need health insurance or health provision. You go to an emergency room. You know, you give them all your information. They'll send you a bill, but if you haven't got the money to pay it, what are they going to do? They're going to turn around and bill the government. We already have government health insurance for people who can't afford it. It's mandated by the laws that the Congress has passed. I don't think they're right, but they're there. So if you need medical care, you can get it. You go to an emergency room and you get it. They can't turn you away. They'll send you a bill. You just tell them, I can't afford to pay it. You're going to have to bill it to the government. And they will. They will. It may hurt your credit rating, but it will. Yeah. Very good, Rover. What credit? Credit? Who has that? Yeah, as of right now, because that provision of the health care bill where you had to go out and buy it was taken down by the Supreme Court, they cannot force you to do that. They can't put you in jail for not having it either. Okay? Your credit can't get any worse? Go to the emergency room. Oh yeah, that was shot down a couple of weeks ago, but in the Supreme Court, the Attorney General of the state of Virginia filed suit against the government, and they got it as far. I'm sorry, it wasn't in the Supreme Court; it was in the Ninth District Court of Appeals, and the Ninth District Court shot it down, and it went before a tribunal of the Ninth District Court, and they found that the judge that found that it was no good was right. And so now it can still go to the Supreme Court. It's whether or not the administration wants to spend the money. And whether or not it's gone as far as the appellate court. It has not been heard by the entire appellate court, only by a three-judge triumvirate. But that's pretty much as far as it needs to go. Someone will probably appeal it to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court will shoot it down as well, because it's definitely, absolutely unconstitutional to tell somebody what they can buy, what they have to buy. You have to buy this. Who the heck are you to tell me what I have to buy? You know, now next you're going to tell me that I have to go to McDonald's and buy a Big Mac. You can't do that. Wouldn't anyway. Put me in jail. Yeah, right, exactly. Ew, put me in jail. I'm not going to eat no Big Mac. You can serve me a Big Mac in jail. I won't eat it. I'm going to lose a lot of weight if that's the case. Okay, 141. There you go. You don't have to buy anything. It's exactly right. It's 1:41. Rip, give them one song and then close the room down and have them go and send them over to Eddie's. Shabbat shalom, y'all. I appreciate you coming. We're gonna do another Midrash next week, Yah willing, and the creek don't rise. And Rip is now going to take over the room. Shavua tov to you all, and we'll see you next week. Amen ve'amen. Hope it was a blessing to you.